Welcome to episode 128 of the Omni Gamers Club podcast, the podcast for games on all platforms, including Nike's. I am Daniel Winter.
And my name is Mark Uessa. Hello, Daniel. How's it going?
I've been better, I'll say. It's been a rough week. I didn't go to PAX Unplugged this year and still somehow managed to get ConCrud, it seems. So I was basically out of commission with the flu for the last week. We'll see how my voice holds up for this podcast, but glad to be on the other end of that. How are you, Mark?
Yeah, I'm okay. I got the Christmas tree in the house today, and I think like my allergies are acting up, maybe because it's live Douglas fir or whatever, like my eyes are reacting. It doesn't help that I'm allergic to cats and I live with two of them, so that might be part of it too, but I seem to be okay here in the basement.
Cats and Christmas trees, two things that go great together.
Yeah, exactly. They sometimes clash at various points, but that's another story. Yeah, things are good otherwise.
Excellent. Well, we've got three courses of gaming coming up. Shall we get straight to it?
Let's do it. Yeah, let's jump into our appetizer section.
Yeah, I just wanted to jump in quickly with a very brief bit of news, just so that my opener there actually makes sense. I saw an article reported from The Verge that designer Gustavo Bonzanini basically turned his Nike sneakers into a Super Nintendo. Basically inserted a Raspberry Pi processor into the tongue of the sneakers, and then like with an RCA port, so completely retro in that sense. And so you can basically treat this one particular shoe as a console and plug it into your TV, play some classic games. SNES specifically, I think, because it was the 25th? No, that can't be right. It must be the 30th anniversary, is it? One of the anniversaries.
Yeah, I mean, Mario had an anniversary, but Mario preceded this NES, so yeah, hard to say.
Excellent. Yeah, but that's just a nice little curiosity. If you want to take your retro gaming up to the next step, there you've got another option. It's not a retail product, I should say. It was just a one-off sample.
Okay, that's cool. So it wasn't like a licensed product?
No.
Interesting, though. Cool. All right. So that makes me think of holiday shopping. I'm going to mention something quickly as well. It's not really a story, just something I noticed. So I saw this deal online and I thought, is this too good to be true? Turns out it is, kind of. Yeah. So I was looking at it, it popped up. And then apparently Google Chromecast is a device that many people, particularly parents, know a lot about. Just like the lightweight cloud-based computer that's been around for a number of years now. They're still making them. And periodically, Google will throw out these like perks or whatever. So I checked the web page and we'll share the links for this. But it turns out that if you buy a new Chromebook, they're giving away a year's worth of GeForce Now, NVIDIA GeForce Now.
And what's the value of that these days?
It's about, for the 1080p edition, it's like 140 Canadian a year.
It's up there.
So just about, you know, 12 Canadian dollars a month. So, you know, like, I think that's worth it. I think that's worth it if you think about it as like a payment plan on a gaming PC. Mm. Or even a payment plan on a high-end video card. That's actually really pretty reasonable over the course of a couple of years. You're paying a whole lot less than $500, $600, $700 for the top of the line video card. Plus, after a couple of years, your video card or PC is old. Whereas if you stay on GeForce Now, they are actually only upgrading the hardware to newer and newer tiers every few months. So not to say that I'm going to support the two largest corporations around, NVIDIA and Google. But in terms of price per dollar, that's actually a really good deal. The Best Buy here in Canada, in Western Canada, was having a deal that their cheapest Chromebook due to Black Friday was $160. But GeForce Now, the 1080 package is $140. So what does that mean? You're basically getting a $20 new Chromebook, if you want to think about it that way. And now there's a catch, I mentioned. So it turns out, I actually thought that this deal was too good to be true, or it was great, so I bought that Chromebook.
Got to spend this money to save money, Mark.
Yeah, exactly. I booted it up, and I got access to GeForce Now. And it's a special tier. They call it GeForce Now Fast Pass, if you want to read it up. Finding the fine print is actually a little bit hard. That's why I had to figure it out myself. But It's basically the 1080p tier. It doesn't support what they call install to play, which basically means you can play non-supported games because they sell you hard drive space as well. So you could play a game that's technically not GeForce Now approved by dedicating some of your hardware space. So it doesn't include that feature, which comes with other premium tiers. And it turns out that very few, a certain number of games are not supported by this FastPass tier. Namely, the one game I wanted to play with my oldest kid, Borderlands 4, which I had bought for Steam. It's supported in the general premium GeForce Now plan, but not in this FastPass plan. So I ended up returning the Chromebook the next day to Best Buy. They had no problem returning it. And somehow I still have GeForce Now.
Oh, there you go.
So I kind of inadvertently walked into a bit of a scam, or I walked into a bit of a deal. I'm not going to tell people to go and replicate what I did, but somehow I still have GeForce Now, fast tier, for free for a year, and it seems to work on my other platforms like tablet, phone, console even, PC, if I wanted to.
And how big is the library on GeForce Now?
Oh, it's very big. It's like over 1,000 games, but it's a little confusing. It shouldn't be compared to something like Netflix or Disney Plus, where you gain an access. You gain access to a library. You only gain access to the virtual hardware. So you have to hook in.
You have to own the games.
Your Steam.
Okay.
You have to hook in your, GOG or Epic games in some cases. Or free-to-play games are, of course, free-to-play.
Mm.
So it doesn't come with games per se.
Licensing a virtual console, basically. But you still have to buy the games.
And the thing is, it doesn't support every game. So I think in some cases it's really useful. Like, for instance, I could play high-end PC game on, low-spec hardware, like, a Steam Deck, my Lenovo Legion Go, or even a tablet, if I just plug in a Bluetooth controller. You could do a similar thing on a Chromebook, which has really low-powered innards. So for some people, it'll be really suitable. But whether the listener it applies to you, that's up to you. Just approach it with caution. But if you are interested in this GeForce Now deal, apparently I read the fine print. It does go until 2027.
Oh.
So if you're planning to buy one in the next couple of years, you're good. Do double check the website. Don't just take my word for it. But hey, if you're interested, there it is.
I am trying to divest myself from Google and Nvidia for what it's worth. So I don't think I'll be taking advantage of that anytime soon.
Yeah, makes sense. But hey, those big corporations, they have their claws everywhere.
Mm-hmm. They'll get you with those deals. Okay, so one bit of news that was of interest to me, we've discussed a little bit, we've talked around the edges of Mothership Month this year. I talked about Mouse Ritter Month last week. But with that in the rearview mirror, there's been some interesting retrospectives on a particular aspect of that which I hadn't talked about, which was basically a sort of live-action mega game that was happening over the course of Mothership Month called Over Under. Did you follow this at all, Mark?
I saw the hashtag here and there, but I didn't look into it closely. Just seemed like another internet trend, but do elucidate.
Yeah, well, so this was basically a mega game designed by Sam Sorensen, who was the designer of one of the most well-known Mothership modules called A Pound of Flesh, and this is set in the same setting as that, I believe 50 years before it. It took place on a Discord server, and so it was able to accommodate as many people who wanted to play. Essentially, there was a curated number of sort of top tier bosses players who could influence the game state, but then hundreds of thousands of people could join up to basically be citizens in this world and vote and influence it in various smaller ways. And I was tentatively interested, partly just to see what it was like for the podcast perspective and to discuss it. I was a little hesitant, partly in just terms of a thing that's happening 24/7 is very hard to switch off of. And I think that's some of the commentary I've seen has been not just that, but also effects of bleed. And when a game is just always happening, it's very hard to switch in and out of the, sort of the two states of whether you're playing or not playing, essentially, right? So that was something, and also just the social anxiety of like missing out of when if it's always on. I'm very unemployed and have too much time on my hand. What am I missing out on? It felt like a bit of a trap. I didn't want to sort of expose myself to be honest. But I was still very interested hearing reports and sort of bits and pieces escaping containment from that game. A lot of like fascinating stories of like culture and little sort of memes, but also like people were forming cults and businesses, and like I saw Kyle Ferren, the artist from like Roots and Oath, was like basically doing character portraits for a lot of characters there and filtering through some of the references and things. So it was fascinating in terms of like I heard very little about the actual game states and a lot about just the culture that was building up. When you get that many people in one space, it just creates a life of its own, right? So in light of that, I did see a couple of follow-up reporting now that it's over, largely from Rascal News. There was one basically on the effect of bleed in the game, breaking down how difficult that was, especially with just the sheer number of people. It was very hard to moderate and curate people's experience. But largely, it seems to have worked remarkably well. Everyone, most people by all accounts had a good time. It is hard to switch off though, obviously. Bleed being a side effect in the most well-intentioned games that have clear sort of boundaries. But this was always going to be a little bit fuzzy, I think. So I encourage people to maybe read up on some of that reporting. I just found it an interesting sort of social experiment, if nothing else. I've so little of what I've heard has anything to do with the actual game design between how that went. I have no idea what faction even won that game, but there's been some. It's been a fascinating sort of exercise in it's a social study. It reminds me a lot of almost like Warcraft guilds. It feels like a role-playing server in World of Warcraft, sort of culture that builds up around that.
The example that came to mind for me was EVE Online.
Mm.
There's many cases of kind of long-storied epic tales of protracted wars and sort of corporate takeovers and a lot of fictional drama that bled over into real life with people investing their own, you know, physical dollars on capital ships and things like that. And I think they've even, like, there's like an EVE Online historian or something who has collected the stories of these sort of legends that have occurred, you know, in the real world.
I think there have been books have been published recording on the events that have occurred and the battles and
yeah. And I think what was it last year, or maybe the year before, there was that blaze ball phenomenon, which I assiduously ignored. I think maybe, you know, I don't want to deride anyone who gets into these online people who might describe themselves as terminally online, these kind of trendy phenomenon. I feel like a lot of it is driven by FOMO, and I don't know, I like to think of myself that's not driven too much by FOMO. You know me, I like to have deals on sales or whatever that's going on, but social phenomenon doesn't really capture me. I don't feel like I need to play the game that's in the zeitgeist or watch the movie that everyone's talking about.
There's probably some similarities to things like, you know, medieval reenactors or LARPers, that sort of thing, where you're like living in that lifestyle for the entire weekend or however long. And it's even like a weekend is a pretty intense experience. This was 30 days or just under that, at least, of intense sort of, the game is always happening. It's very hard to know. Not only is there no like off point to the game, but there's also a lot of fuzziness as to what's in character and out of character. That was always designed to be a little fuzzy. I think there were some rules that were sort of tacked on mid-game to sort of clarify some of sort of out of character commentary. But it's very tricky to create a real liminal space, I think, in between like the sense of where the game begins and ends.
Yeah, I should say to anyone who might, you know, feel slightly offended that I actually kind of admire that commitment to those individuals who do get together and engage in these kind of really intense real-time affairs, be it, you know, for a weekend, like you said, or be it for 30 days. Or even, like, you know, the one thing I do am a little bit wistful about is tangential to theater is some of these short-lived experiences, like the Sleep No More performances are sort of legendary, and they've had quote-unquote bleed into the gaming industry. There's many, you know, game designs that or be it digital or tabletop that have sort of tried to capture some of the kind of the magic that happened during that very, very non-traditional, innovative, you know, very provocative experience. Sleep No More is this theater experience. You can look for it online, but, you know, it touched upon, you know, it affected things like the game, was it Tacoma? I think that the one about the space station directly influenced by it. Just these sort of non-linear theatrical experiences. I am sad that I missed those sorts of things. You know, a decade or two ago, there was, you know, Angels in America, things like that. I sort of wished, oh, if only I was there, the, you know, the legendary production of Godspell in the, what was the 1970s with the SCTV cast, sort of legendary events like that. A lot of these things I could never have attended anyways, but, you know, as a armchair historian, can always be wistful. Yeah, if only I was there. Kind of like Woodstock, you know? It's like, wow, that happened.
Yeah, I mean, there was... It really is like a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for something like this that, I mean, not to say that it's exploitative, but it can cause people to go in much deeper than they'd otherwise intend to, if you know what I mean. I mean, there was one faction or cult or something in the game who ended up instituting an official bedtime to sort of force their members to, like, log off, basically.
Wow. What you don't want is you don't want those, what is it, Stanford Prison Experiment situation going on where you get too much totalitarian control in there.
Well, this did have, like, deception as a primary mechanic, which obviously is going to lead to some bad feelings with that bleed coming into it. So that's partly why I avoided it. I think I just didn't need that anxiety 24/7.
Well, maybe in a year or so there'll be a book written about, or a book or two written about.
Yeah, I'm very much interested in this as a social phenomenon from the outside looking in.
Very cool. All right, I'm going to mention one more news story sort of this time related to deals. I don't know if this is a limited time deal, but I did want to mention it because I've been using it. So, you know, I read a lot of manga. I don't like the product that shall be named that ends with plus. That's, you know, from a big corporation where you, like, pay an amount of money and you get an unlimited amount of books. So, because I don't want to support that, I was looking at other options and I stumbled upon Kobo. So Kobo is a Canadian company. It's now owned by a Japanese company. Yeah, but it started in Canada, so it was always on my radar. And they're basically, they make e-readers, kind of like Kindles, but not owned by Amazon. So they have an in-house service that's pretty much like the same as Amazon's online subscription. It's called Kobo Plus. And, you know, it always looked like a pale shadow of that other unnamed service. So it never really got on my mind. But I did look at it more closely, and I looked at the back catalog, and it actually has a surprising number of the manga that I was interested in reading. It doesn't have any of the Shueisha stuff, like the Shonen Jump titles that you can get off of that Shonen Jump app. Doesn't matter, I'm subscribed to that separately anyway. But it does have a lot of books from the publisher Kodansha. And Kodansha puts out, like, some, you know, fairly notable stuff. Probably the biggest title breakout success they have is the Attack on Titan series. And there's a few others as well. Fire Force, there's a number of other examples I can mention. Popular shonen manga and even some romance and even some more like edgy stuff that usually doesn't get talked about. But anyways, they're having a free preview for a couple of weeks. I'm on that right now. But then they were having a promotion where it's like $1.99 a month. Compared to the regular $9.99 a month Canadian. So that struck me as really, really impressive. Even if I subscribed to it for 1 month and read all I could read manga, you know, I can read a lot of manga really fast compared to one or two novels a month at my usual pace. So I've just been reading kind of nonstop on that platform for the grand price of, you know, a couple months for $2, which sounds pretty great. So if that's of any interest to the readers out there, the listeners out there, maybe go check it out. Kobo, the app, is available on Apple, Android, certainly Kobo Reader, e-readers.
So you don't need a Kobo Reader to subscribe to that?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, you can just download it just like you would the Kindle app on your iPhone or Android phone. And you could even read it on PC. But you could also read it on a tablet. So there's a lot of options there, and there's a lot of good manga there. The books, not a great selection. So I wouldn't read it if you're just into novels. But there might be a couple that you're interested in. Manga, definitely there's some interesting options there, and there's some Western comics as well. So maybe check that out. Couple dollars for a month of unlimited manga.
Pretty cool. Okay, did you have anything else you wanted to talk about for the appetizer today?
No, I think that's good for me. Excellent. Got deals on the brain.
I made the mistake of going out to the big mall here in Vancouver yesterday. We had a dentist appointment. Only realized in hindsight that it was during Black Friday and Christmas, and it was a bit of a fight getting in and out of there, shall we say.
I can only imagine. I did go to Best Buy, like I mentioned, but only for online pickup and drop-off, so it wasn't so bad.
Okay, shall we get to our main course?
Let's do it, yeah. Did you want to start us off, or shall I?
Yeah, I'll start us off quickly, because I had a couple of little things to talk about. I was hoping to get to some tabletop solo games this week. Unfortunately, didn't really have the mind for it. All I could really manage was grinding out some JRPGs, basically, and sleeving some Millennium Blade cards, and that's about it. So I've got a few older games I'd played and still needed to talk about. So first of all, I was get to the retro zone, and I'm continuing to work through various retro backlogs, and over the last few months I've basically played through all three games in the Donkey Kong Country trilogy. So this was three games that came out on the SNES between 94 and 96, so they came out pretty rapid fire. Mark, I don't think you've played these, right?
No, I did have a SNES. I mostly played RPGs on it. Like I said, platformers kind of escaped me after Super Mario World. So I definitely haven't played these. And the Donkey Kong games are kind of a big gap in my library, to be honest.
Well, this does have a lot of similarities to Super Mario World, in that having, I mean, it's a 2D platformer. The primary goal is get from A to B, just get to the end of the level. It's not really a flag. It's just like I think it's different in each one of them, but hit the barrel, hit the pulley at the end of the level, basically. And it does have an overworld similar to Mario, with like split into sort of sub worlds, and there'll be like five or six levels in each world, basically. I think it's only six worlds in each game or thereabouts. It didn't really get into that sort of overworld secrets and sort of the moving around and a lot of mini games and other things happening until Donkey Kong Country 3 was where they started playing with that. It was a pretty simple in that sense, but I mean, largely it's there for the platforming itself, right? And I mean, I've spoken recently about the Donkey Kong Bonanza and how I was felt pretty whelmed on that, and just how it had gotten away from the actual platforming itself and into these lots of little micro goals. And this just gets like, it was fun to go back to the origin of Donkey Kong, but the platforming aspect of it. At least I'd owned 2 and 3 as a kid. I know I'd finished them, but I sort of a gaming grail of mine was that there was like a secret, I think it was sort of the Lost World in Donkey Kong 2 that was always too hard and I hadn't been able to beat. So I wanted to go back and do that as well. So, I mean, just quickly, I guess I'll start at the first one. I mean, I think it was the most difficult of the three. It was quite tricky. It escalated pretty smoothly in terms of the difficulty curve, but it was very little there other than just get from A to B. There were some secrets. Those weren't really formalized until the later game. There wasn't really much point in getting all the secrets. And funnily enough, like the thing about these games is they're still so beholden to the artifact of lives that just, I mean, it feels so pointless. And like so many of all the collectibles, like all the secrets and all the collectibles are all just giving you more bananas, which give you more lives. But like, there was never really a stakes to that anyway, because I don't think if you die. Like, I don't think if you lose all your lives, it's not like you have to start again. You just have to, like, go back to that start of that level, basically. I mean, spoilers, I was using, like, the rewind feature on Nintendo Online, because it wasn't particularly engaging to, like, there's nothing to engage with there in terms of, like, the friction of how many lives do I have. Is this not an interesting mechanic? I didn't think.
Yeah, lives are just the specter of the arcade game phenomenon, which home console games were born out of. So it's a outdated modality that doesn't even get used nowadays. You know, there's freaking Dark Souls or whatever. You can die as many times as you want to in that game. Because, you know what? You paid the money for the game, presumably. You get to, however short the game is, or however many times you have to die, it's up to you.
Or then you've got the other extreme of roguelikes, where you can only die once. it's very hard to maintain friction in between those two states, basically. So, I mean...
it's always a new game. Roguelites, you always make a little bit of progress. Mm. So dying is part of that game design.
Yes. So, I mean, the thing that was surprising to me is how early, even from the first game, they were really experimenting and getting quite creative with how they mixed up the levels. Like, both visually, like, you might have a level that goes from daytime to nighttime over the course of the level, to, the mechanics, obviously, the minecart levels were there from the get-go. That was really classic. You might have... It's blurring together, but there were a lot of, like, mini objectives that you might have to do along the way, like to fuel up or to open gates or to freeze enemies that were invulnerable. And so they really were quite clever in mixing up how you're engaging with the game level to level. I mean, something that I believe I spoke about with Rayman Legends, which is one of my favorite platforming, but it has this fantastic momentum where, like, you'll bounce on one enemy and it's just so perfectly tuned that you'll bounce from one enemy to the next, and like, you'll just bounce seamlessly between them or from one barrel into the next. Like, there's this, like, perfectly balanced timing that when you can nail feels great. And obviously on very simple hardware back then. I mean, it's not as crisp as something like Super Mario World with those sort of weird lumpy mod, like, they look like 3D models out of plasticine. It's fascinating. I don't know how they achieved it. I don't know if there were actual models that they had created or something, but yeah, it's quite clever.
I know how they achieved it. It was basically a cheat. It's the same technique, in theory, that they used for the Mortal Kombat games.
Mm.
Basically, whereas the Mortal Kombat games were live actors who were photographed and they made sprites out of, in this case, Rare, as I understand it, they did make 3D models, and then they photographed them as stills. So the stills of 3D models, you know, you get 12 frames, 24 frames, or whatever that you need to do a run motion. They basically looped that as sprites, as 2D sprites. So it was 3D models, but they were rendered in 2D. That's the way a Super Nintendo could actually run a game that looked 3D. It was a cheat.
I mean, it is a very lush-looking game. You've got the parallax animation with the multiple layers, and it is, like, impressive to look at for its time. I mean, it's not for its time. It's still impressive to look at now, I think. And the music, I mean, that's something that I felt lacking in Bonanza. I still think that the music in the original is, I mean, it's got that funk to it. I still really enjoy that sort of that Rare, capital R, Rare, the company. Their oeuvre of design. I was a big fan of that. So, I mean, jumping from that into Donkey Kong Country 2, which so the trick to that was, in the first game, you've got Donkey Kong and Diddy Kong, which you can basically switch between, but they also act as like a secondary life. If one of them dies, you can still play as the other one. And in the second game, Donkey Kong gets kidnapped and so then swaps in with Dixie Kong as a girl Kong now. But she had her own completely different mechanic of movement. Like, she can, like, twirl her hair and float a little more. So there is a really interesting asymmetry to how the characters interact. And you might switch back and forth to navigate particular sections. Two also formalized a lot of the secrets and bonuses. There was now, like, two bonus barrels every level and one bonus coins. It was a little more consistent what those were. So there was a sort of more of a consistent completion bonus to work towards. And I think most people, I think, seem to think it's the pinnacle of where they really nailed that game design. Three, again, swapped out Diddy Kong for Kiddy Kong, I think it was. Just basically a toddler who screams and throws a tantrum whenever he dies, essentially. So interesting choice there. But the really interesting part of that one was this: they really innovated with the overworld. And it had this sense of like an adventure puzzle game where you might discover an item in one part of the map and have to take it to a character on another part of the map to like unlock a shortcut or unlock a bonus level or one of the collectibles or something like that. There wasn't as much of it as I remembered. It was only really a couple of like chains to follow in there and a few sort of secret caves to find collectibles in for the ultra super secret ending. But at the end, I think for the third game, they ran out of ideas. The ideas were just a little more gimmicky, I think. It was probably definitely the easiest of the bunch. Like, the lives were just completely redundant by that point because they're just throwing lives at you constantly. Still a lot of fun as, like, this big adventure theme and the exploring the overworld. But definitely starting to show the age of like running these out year after year. It wasn't a lot of true innovation, I don't think, by that point. But still, I think they all still hold up as classic platforming games.
How long would you say that each of these games were? How long did they take you to?
If you're not messing around with the lives and just like exploiting that Nintendo Online Rewind feature as much as you can, probably about 5 to 6 hours each, I think, to be honest. And that was 100%ing them as well. So you could get through them in like probably a few hours if you just want to see the ending of them.
Got it. Yeah. So many of those older games are artificially extended through, I don't know, just being difficult or...
By being 10 and not being able to beat them.
Yeah, having those limitations. Or not having the internet to check for the solution in some cases. All right, I'm going to mention my Retro Corner as well. I've been mostly playing newer games, I guess you could call it. But I'm still playing retro games because it's just me. Speaking of Nintendo Online, Nintendo Classics, I've been playing a Game Boy Color game called Pokemon Trading Card Game, which is part of that service. You mentioned it last week, so I'm not going to rehash that, but I am still continuing to play it. I caught a couple of gym badges already, so making some decent progress. I think I got a quarter of them so far.
So it keeps that framing structure of getting the 8 gym badges? Interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. The game is actually really rudimentary. Like, basically, the only art assets are the overworld map and the gym interior, which is pretty much the same interior on every gym. So it's like super, super cut down. And obviously, they spent most of their energy on the TCG playing engine, which runs surprisingly well.
Is there like deck building in that, or is it just like pre-built decks?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. No. Interesting. No.
It's pretty sophisticated, but I would prefer to hold on to discuss that further.
Oh, okay.
In the future.
Yes.
I think you and I are going to be discussing Pokemon TCG a little bit more in depth.
Yeah, we couldn't quite sync up this last week, but we'll definitely plan to get to that soon. And I'm going to try that Pokemon Game Boy game.
Yeah, and I've been also comparing it to the modern app as well, so it'll be we'll have stuff to discuss.
Yeah, I did boot up that TCG Pocket, I think it's called, the newer sort of the simplified card game?
That's the one. Cool. All right, so other retro stuff I've been playing, I rented Metroid Prime. So I was playing Zero Mission the other day. Now I'm playing Metroid Prime 1 because the Prime series is in the news. The 4 is coming out momentarily, and we touched upon that a little bit another episode or two ago. But most of my time has been spent playing a slightly older game. This is what I spent most of my time on, so I'm going to talk about it at length. It's called Phantasian Neo Dimension. Now, the interesting thing about this game is that it is by the key players in the original Final Fantasy series. So this game is written and produced by Hironobu Sakaguchi, who was the kind of the front man for Final Fantasy, basically like 1.
The first one? 9. Okay. Interesting.
Definitely 1.
Okay.
And composer Nobuo Uematsu.
I know that name.
who's the composer of Final Fantasy 1 and others beyond that, is also back. So two heavy hitters there. Aside from this, this is like Sakaguchi's production company. This is Mistwalker. So Mistwalker, who produced games as far back as Blue Dragon, if you recall that, for Xbox. Other ones like, I forget that kind of like darker one, like Lost, I forget the name. Anyways, Mistwalker has a bit of a legacy of their own. And this game is interesting. I found out that after I rented it from the library, that I already have this game. Or I already have access to this game. Because this game originally came out in 2021 for, get this console, get this, the Apple TV.
Okay.
Or Apple TV or iOS, I guess, Apple platforms. This game came out as the original Apple Arcade series.
Huh.
So all the way back in 2021 is when it originally came out as, it's just called Fantasian back then, not Neo Dimension. Neo Dimension is sort of like a remaster or recreation of it.
Right.
So far, the biggest differences I can see is that it now features voice acting. So I booted it up on my iPad just to compare it, and it's the same game. Hmm. It's totally the same game. So you might already have access to it if you have Apple Arcade. You can go check it out on your phone or Apple TV like I did. And it seems to be the old edition. So it's still the original Fantasian, no voice acting in the old platform. And Neo Dimension, the new version, came out in 2024. So fairly recent.
Yeah, I remember following this when it first came out, but I was not invested in the Apple platform at the time. The really striking thing I ever seem to recall was that it was like real life dioramas that they'd handcrafted, right?
That is right. Yeah, that is one thing. It's actually a little bit subtle. Like, it just looks like CG at the beginning. And the cool thing is, if you just like check out the intro CG movie, it has like a very, very direct reference to Final Fantasy VII.
Hmm.
Basically, like, there's this like high sci-fi world, and then basically this agent is crawling through this like high-tech facility, and he's blowing it up. He's blowing up this like high-tech facility, and it looks just like Cloud destroying that Subtle. Facility in Midgar. So it's a very, very direct reference there. And there's other references as well. There's references to Blue Dragon in there if you go to a certain bar in Fantasia. Anyways, yeah, you said dioramas, and I only really started noticing it after the kind of tutorial mission. You end up walking into this town. It's the first little town, and it literally looks like a storybook.
Hmm.
Like, the town is Yoshi's designed Island, in such a way.
Yoshi's story.
Yeah, it's designed in such a way that it's not like literally opening up a book, but like the town design is kind of like unfolding towards you, and you walk around the town square. You can walk up the hill into some of the hinterlands above there. But what's really cool is that, I don't know if it's cool. It's very distinct anyways, is that you can actually turn angles in this game. So when you walk your character off the screen, which would be the extent of the kind of the close-up camera angle, it will actually bend a corner and go around to another area. And it smoothly transitions between the previous to the next, because what they've done is they've just like panned the camera controls over it and tilted the angle. So you'll see another perspective of the dioramas, and the character follows along, and the characters are facing a different direction now. So you bent around the angle, and now they were heading, you know, west. Now they're heading south. It's kind of like early PS1 games. If you ever played the original Resident Evil,
back designed in the day, from very particular perspectives and camera angles.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. Because that was kind of like not really CG. They had static backgrounds, and your 3D character would walk over the static background. And once they reached the end of the map, they would transition to, they would do a fast cut into a different angle. But your character is coming now down the hallway from a totally different angle, and you had to readjust your controls to map to it. This one is a little bit in between real 3D environments and that. Basically, like I said, when you walk across the screen, it smoothly transitions. The effect is actually really quite solid, but it's still a little bit disorienting.
A little bit like what I did in Harold Halibut, right? Like with scanning 3D models and putting those into the game, basically.
Yeah, that's actually a really good reference.
Or Donkey Kong Country.
In Harold Halibut, as I recall, it was still more smooth.
Mm.
You recall that kind of underground cave where he meets the other race. And there's kind of like the water-dappled cave. It's very, very 3D. He walks two steps and the camera's moving, following him all the way along. This isn't that. This is like
distinctly very zoomed out.
One scene, next scene, and it just quickly transitions in between them. Anyways, aside from the technical, this game is actually really lovely to look at. The production design is fantastical, but it is, like I said, has like a lot of sci-fi aspects to it as well. And it's not as dark and grimy as Final Fantasy VII. It is a little bit more kind of bubbly and poppy and colorful, and everything seems like a little bit more stylized and smooth and a little bit storybook. And the character models are, you know, fully 3D. They're obviously more high def than the original Final Fantasy VII, but they're much lower resolution than the Final Fantasy VII remake, let's just say. The characters are very, you know, simplistic. You start off with this protagonist who has amnesia, you know, so that old trope. You quickly run into a young, earnest town maiden who looks a lot like Aerith, to be honest, from that previously mentioned game. And then you eventually get a third character who's this kind of like strong-willed princess, but she's like a fighting princess, which is like the best kind of princess, right? It's like the no-nonsense, like I take action into my own hands kind of character. So, you know, they're not groundbreaking, but they're, you know, quite charming and likable characters. So that
obviously
I like a lot.
Playing a lot on nostalgia with that sort of storybook vibe, right?
Very much. I think it's the right move. Because obviously Mistwalker is not a massive company. It doesn't have buckets and buckets of money like Square Enix does. They did a lot with a little. And the small scope of it is kind of charming as a result. That said, this is a very, very linear game. In the first part of it that I played, I've only played about 6-7 hours of this game. It is very, very linear. And I'm only slightly getting to the point where things are starting to branch out a bit. I'm entered the first real big town. The little starter town wasn't much to talk about. And every other area has just been totally linear. Now, one thing that this game is doing that is innovative is their combat. So you wouldn't know that at first. When you just start playing this game and you do the intro tutorial, it's like, whatever, I've seen this before. But two things that they do are cool. Each of the characters, you start off with one, and then there's just like this little tutorial companion, and they behave differently. The protagonist, the character's attacks are based off of trajectories. So imagine, if you will, a game like Final Fantasy, the classic ones, where you have, you know, your characters along one side and your enemies on the other side, and then they're just kind of attacking each other in waves, right? Well, those were turn-based and they were controlled through menus. This game is also turn-based and controlled through menus, but instead of just like picking a cursor and being like, that one, I'm attacking that one, you actually have attacks that have area of effect, but those area of effect are linear for the most part. So, protagonist shoots any number of enemies in a straight line. So, you can tilt the angle of the attack up or down, and you line it up so that you're trying to obviously hit as many characters in that line as possible. And the characters are not, like, rigidly set up in a grid. They're, like, kind of scattered. Kind of like that drop dungeon game you were mentioning. Like, they're just kind of dropped on a field, and Bullock's they're kind of spaced. They're kind of spaced semi-randomly.
Okay. So it's like positioning and there's a spatiality to how it's
set up. Yeah, absolutely.
It's not just a list.
That one is very important. And not every character is like that.
Okay.
The second character you run into, who's that sort of companion magic user character, she has a spell attack that works off of arcs. So protagonist shoots a straight line. her attacks can shoot a straight line, but it can also arc, so you can have like a curve shape attack, which obviously helps you fill out certain angles.
So it's like sort of Peglin or Peggle, I guess, for Final Fantasy.
Yeah, I suppose, although you're obvious, like, the attack like just goes straight through, so you're not like...
So bouncing, but yeah.
Some yeah, trajectory, you're not rebounding. And... Yeah, you're aiming, I guess, and having an area effect. And the third character has like what you would consider the traditional area of effect attack. So she can drop like a radius, and she can gather like, you know, four or five enemies within that sphere, so long as those characters are close to each other. So what that creates is a really, really enticing combat system where, depending on how many enemies you have on screen, you might attack them in an order that leaves enough in a close proximity so that your companions can attack them effectively. So this is really nothing I've seen in any other turn-based RPG, and I think it gives it a fresh flavor. And the second innovative technique that this game includes, they've trademarked it, it's called the Dimension System. So Dimension is short for, I don't know, Dimension Dungeon.
Yeah, I see what you
mean. And what this means is actually really, really interesting. So it's this device that the protagonist finds, and I think it was invented by his father or something like that, who's gone missing, of course. The parent always goes missing. And what it does is it lets you ignore random battles for a time. And it lets you store them up.
Bank them?
It lets you bank them. So imagine, if you will, you're playing Final Fantasy 1, except you have the Dimension Engine. And if you have it enabled, you can totally disable it. If you want to disable it entirely, just ignore it. You can totally do that. But if you choose to enable it, say you're playing Final Fantasy, when there would be a random battle, it says, it sort of flashes, and then a number shows up next to your Dimension Engine. It says, 6 enemies banked. And then you can, whenever you want to, you can attack those enemies. But when the next time a random battle would occur, it says, 13 enemies banked. And the next time a random battle happens, it'll say, 18 enemies banked. And eventually, you're going to bank so many enemies where it's going to be actually really difficult.
It's a bit of like a risk reward system, I guess.
Yeah, and okay. I think that's like incredibly enticing, because depending on where you are, well, first of all, it will not bank enemies that you're meeting for the first time. So if you go to a new region and there's a new type of enemies here, you will have to encounter that at least once. But if the random encounter includes enemies that you've met at least once, then it will work in the Dimension Engine. And eventually, the Dimension System has a limit of 30 enemies, which is plenty. 30 enemies at once for any one battle is kind of hectic, right? But that's really cool, because it lets you, if you're exploring a map, trying to find hidden things in the map, you're just kind of going with the flow. And every time you have a random battle, you get taken out of that flow. And if you have a good handle on those previously mentioned attack abilities, like, you want to use them on a bunch of enemies at once, because then you're going to have maximum results. So this lets you do the best of both of those. It lets you battle when you want to, it lets you focus when you want to, and when you choose to have those battles, you can have a big battle and let it all blow out and have a really kind of fun tactical experience playing that out. And I thought that was really, really satisfying, except this one time where I had like a kind of a set piece battle where there's a bunch of creatures were attacking the ship that I was on. And for some reason, the angle shifted from the side of the characters, the profile of the characters, to behind the characters. And now I was facing forward. And with that, like, you couldn't see how the angles were working anymore. You could see like little icons next to the enemies, but basically the screen was full of like 50 baddies,
like a camera bug or something,
at a time. So like the camera work was just really not good.
Okay.
But like I said, that was a one-off, so I can only imagine that.
So does this system give you information on what's being banked, or just the number?
Just the number.
Okay, so it's still a bit of a surprise as to what you're going to get. Like, is there a sense of like certain enemies being tougher when they're combined, but perhaps it wouldn't otherwise experience together, or is it just a bit of a
possibly? They definitely do mix they definitely do mix up the range of enemies, and of course the type of enemies you're going to encounter is based on the region of the map or the world map you're on. Other cool things about that is that, and so there's probably typically like three kind of types of baddies in every part of the world. So you probably only face those. Other cool things are when you unlock the Dimension Engine, you know, you might be facing like, 10, 15 enemies at a time. There are also these power-ups that are dropped throughout the map. And depending on how you aim your attack, if you hit those power-ups, your next attack is going to be stronger. So there's these buffs spaced around. So now you have some more choices. Risk reward. Do you go for the buffs or do you just go for the enemies? And these are really enticing choices. I think this is clever and innovative. And obviously people aren't talking about this.
Yeah.
I suppose 2001 is relatively new. And because it was on an alternative platform like Apple Arcade, maybe the games press didn't really pick up on it. But I think this book that I just finished reading recently, Fight Magic Items, which I believe you read.
Yes.
Was just starting to talk about this game in the final chapters.
Right.
Kind of wrapping up Hironobu Sakaguchi's part, which is a big part of that book. So obviously it was on people's radars, but this mechanism doesn't get mentioned enough times. Maybe because kind of the rest of the game is kind of ho-hum. So I would recommend if anyone's interested in JRPGs, especially old school ones, that they should try this out at least for maybe like 3 or 4 hours and see if it's of interest to you.
Yeah, definitely.
Maybe you already have access.
It seems like it really expands the tactical options for them beyond what you'd normally experience in a typical JRPG.
For certain, yeah. It is not your plain Jane old JRPG that you played 1,000 times before, even though it does carry a lot of those qualities over. And because it's Sakaguchi, basically he doesn't care about that. He's like, I invented that stuff. It doesn't matter that every healing item is pretty much acts the same way. I think they're even called Phoenix Feathers instead of Phoenix Downs. Like, this guy, he's not ashamed of that sort of stuff. Like, whatever, he's just going to use the same old techniques that are used before. Lots of character tropes. I told you it was a fairly linear game. The story is kind of ho-hum as well, but there are some exciting set pieces. It plays a lot like typical kind of adventure anime manga sort of thing. So if that is of interest to you, I think it's definitely interesting. I will try and keep playing it. I don't know how long it is in total, but unless I stop seeing interesting things out of it, I will continue playing this and see if there's any other innovations as well. Oh, other thing I should mention. Maybe this is due to budget as well, but interestingly enough, there are a lot of like audio novel sequences in this game. So when the emotion hits a certain point, when the characters are trying to communicate with each other in a certain way, rather than having a big, expensive, long CG cutscene, they have these kind of like gentle, atmospheric audio novels that have like lots of hand-drawn artwork, and the text is appearing on the screen in very kind of stylish ways, kind of like a little bit like Neon Genesis Evangelion, you know, lots of text that is like animated in certain ways with atmospheric voiceovers, nice music. I think they're actually really effective, and like I said, the right thing to do if you don't have a large budget. I think that's a nice touch. So, yeah, I recommend this game. Fantasian, Neo Dimension. This is a solid, you know, B-grade game. Which, like I said, interests me a great deal.
I've had my eye on it, but in typical Square Enix fashion, the remaster is quite expensive. I've been waiting for the price to come down a bit.
Yeah, is it Square Enix? I don't even know if it is.
I thought it was, perhaps not. But
It is published by Square Enix. You're right. Neo Dimension is. Fantasian, the original, wasn't.
Right. Yeah.
I think it was published directly through Apple. So get it on the platform you can. Neo Dimension, by the way, I played it on Nintendo Switch.
I mean, does the voice acting add a lot, do you think? Is it good voice acting?
it's fine.
Okay.
It's fine. It's totally like standard isekai anime, whatever.
Mm.
It's fine.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyways,
do what you will. Okay. One newer game that I have played, and in fact, brand new game, recently at the Vancouver Game Garden, I had highlighted, I mean, my number one game that gave the best impression there was one called Ambrosia Sky. It's out now, at least the first part of it, Act 1 of one of three, I believe. It's not entirely clear what that arrangement is. But this is developed and published by Soft Rain, I believe a studio, it's a Canadian studio, I don't remember where exactly they're based, I think out east somewhere. Basically, the short description is that it's Power Wash Simulator meeting an immersive sim. That's definitely the impression that it gives up front. You're exploring these somewhat haunted looking space stations in first person, and you have basically a big water pistol that you're using to clean off various forms of fungus that have grown on these space stations. So story-wise, you're playing a character who is a scarab, who is part of some mysterious group who's searching for immortality or some kind of secret, and your latest mission has sent you back to the space station where you grew up, essentially. So you've got a lot of baggage coming back here, but something has... If you're being sent here, it's because something has gone bad. These people have been harvesting fungus, but it's gotten out of hand and killed everyone, essentially. You're going in after everyone has either died or evacuated to play the cleanup crew, essentially, and try and find some mysterious remnants that you might be able to use for your experiments. And so it's a mix of, I mean, going into each, there's like 9 levels that are all fairly standalone. You go in, you're exploring to look for like logs and collectibles, and there's various forms of fungus that will get in your way. And I said that it's like an immersive sim. Unfortunately, what you see in that first half an hour is basically what you're going to get over the course of the several hours it takes to finish the game. It's most of the tricks you see are going to be shown up front. There's only a couple of forms of fungus that you're going to find. How you get rid of those is fairly rudimentary. I mean, like Power Wash Simulator, you're largely just clearing them away. Sometimes there's a slight, not so much puzzle, but like an interactive element where there's these explosive nodules or these electric nodules that you need to like detach before you can go in and clean up properly. Or there's these electric nodules that they sort of chain like these sort of electric roots, and they'll chain through to various other electric parts of the ship and might overload or close off certain doors or passageways. And so you'll need to like be creative in how you destroy these nodes, basically open or activate certain parts of the ship. Unfortunately, that's like the only real level of immersive sim that you ever come across. It's only got those couple of tricks, really. And I'd really hoped to find something a little more of this. I don't know if it's not really fair to say that it's not an immersive sim. It's just that's the impression that it gives. You find these, you know, this haunted abandoned ship, you see these interactive elements, and you feel like you want a little bit more from that. But what is there is quite fun. I mean, it's hard to say what the goal is exactly. Largely, it's just going in and finding a key collectible, usually a body, or there's something on the ship you need to find and retrieve. Most of the cleaning is fairly incidental. And I did like the cleaning. It's very sort of contemplative and methodical the way you go through that. But you don't really need to engage in it a lot. You only need to like clear as much to get through this doorway to get to the next room, and then you can move on. Like, once you've completed the mission, you can go back in to like get 100% clearance. That doesn't really do anything. It basically just ticks a box. There's no story delivery. There's no context for why you might want to do that, which I think is a bit of a missed opportunity. I think they could have doubled down on like the fact that you're cleaning up instead of just retrieving, perhaps, and played up that side of the game. I mean, beyond that, you are experiencing a lot of text logs in true immersive sim fashion. You're finding a lot of terminals where people have a lot of emails, essentially, back and forth. Each level is fairly standalone, and like there'll be 2 or 3 characters within this location who will be communicating. And most of these will be some like ghost from your character's past, which it's all engaging. I think the character work that's there is all quite strong. It all was a little bit brief, and again, left me wanting a little bit more. Like, they're all brief snippets and, like, interchanges between this one setting. There's not really a lot of perspective onto the bigger picture. And what little you do see of the bigger picture is really fascinating. It's like some kind of whale fall scenario, like some giant cosmic Leviathan has died around the rings of Saturn, is my understanding. And you're basically, like, harvesting what's left. The fungus is like some form of, like, parasite that's been growing on this body. But I don't really have a sense of place. Like, most of these locations are, like, standalone missions without having a sense of, like, where this is in the bigger picture, how it fits into this body. You never really see it or experience it. Like, there's just small hints that seem really interesting, but I wanted to see a little more of that. There's one level where you basically start outside of a ship, and, like, you're in space in zero G, and you basically have to approach the ship, and you clean it from every side, or at least you can, to, like, try and access it and find the records inside. And that was, like, super interesting, like, basically giving you a really all-encompassing perspective on this ship from top to bottom, and the different systems, and opening the different doors. And I felt that was really engaging. But most of the time, you're stuck into the airlock. You walk through a series of rooms and explore them with little incentive beyond get the end goal. And there's a few collectibles along the way that don't do anything. So beyond the logs, and getting to the next mission, there's not really a lot of incentive here. I think there's a bit of a missed opportunity. And again, not that this is a bad game. I really like what's there. And I think it has so much potential that it's just a really missed opportunity. If one element of this game had just been elevated a little bit more, I think it could have been something special. But as it is, it's just not quite enough of any one element of the game. They're not quite interacting enough. I mean, it's a gorgeous looking game, for one thing. I mean, it's what I hadn't realized is the artist is Adam Volker, who I'd actually run into at a couple of VanCaf conventions here in Vancouver. He illustrated some Magic the Gathering cards and a few other video games that I really liked. The Creature in the Well, I think it was. And it was really distinctive, sort of psychedelic, oil slick color. Like, it's a very abstracted, sort of broad stroke coloring and very, very dark, moody atmosphere in the game. That's really gorgeous to look at. I just felt this, like, it was just lacking a little bit of substance in the mechanics and story, unfortunately.
Yeah, a Power Wash Simulator is obviously a big hit, and I think there's even a number two. Hmm. So kudos to that studio for having success there. Obviously, it's a very satisfying game mechanism and very appealing to others. To me, though, that playing through just the demo didn't really appeal to me. I felt like I needed something more to make me keep playing more than just the power washing. It wasn't interesting enough for me. So, you know, at very least, I'm intrigued that Ambrosia Sky does give you, you know, that additional layer, that there is a story, there's a reason, a plot for why things are going on. And some of the art looks, you know, quite appealing as well. So it still sounds interesting to me. But depending on the cost or whatever the time, I will definitely check it out.
I'm not clear what the release schedule is for this, because there is this is part one. Assumingly, there's going to be a part two and three. It feels like those would be standalone products, but this really feels like an early access. If this was marketed as that, I would be much less down on it. But it has been released as a final product of a larger story that's got more to come. But I'd like to see them polish off this first rather than move on to the more story. There is, like, an upgrade path. Like, you can have new types of the stuff that you're shooting. You can have special propellant that clears away things faster, or has fire, or has electricity to engage with those cycles more. But within, like, three levels, I'd had, like, 90% of the upgrades. So, like, there wasn't really much tension there. Maybe that could have, like, that would give you the incentive to go back and clean more, but, like, the balance was just felt really off, unfortunately. So, I'm still definitely going to keep an eye on it. It is a promising concept. I'd like to see them shift it up, but if all they're going to do is, like, move on with more story, it's not quite enough for me, unfortunately.
Yeah, I can pretty much guarantee you in a year or two's time, there'll be a complete edition sold at some sort of discount. So maybe I'll check it out then. Cool, cool. What do you think? Should we move on to dessert?
If you're ready, yeah.
Let's do it. Okay, so I'll start us off. All right, this time around, I didn't read a novel or a manga. I mean, I did read those things, but I'm not going to talk about them. I actually watched a movie for once in a while. I watched this recently. It's an older, slightly older movie that I've been meaning to get to. It's called Godzilla Minus One from 2023 from Toho, of course, a longtime creator of Godzilla movies. This one, you know, out of Japan, unlike some of the confusing kind of Hollywood East-West collaboration movies with Kong. I don't really know what's going on there.
I get this one confused with Shin Godzilla was the other one. They came out fairly close to each other.
Yeah. Well, the difference is Shin Godzilla takes place in modern times, and Minus One takes place in 1945, and the immediate years following World War II. And that's actually the first point with this movie. I don't want to spoil anything, but I think it's pretty clear from the trailers what's going on, is that this, for the first time, this movie takes place like immediately in the post-war era, which is not a really popular setting for a lot of Japanese movies. I think there's still a lot of deep set sort of like shame in that time of history. Generally, the population, from what I can tell, creators at least, really, if they look at it at all, they look at it in really critical terms. And I think this movie continues to do that. There's a deep set sort of lack of trust and faith in the post-war government and the military in general. The occupation army, the American army is there, and they mention it in the sort of short newsreels or whatever, but they sort of conveniently sidestep that from when Godzilla appears. The Americans can't help. Japanese, you're on your own, which is, I think, more for plot reasons than anything like that. Like, they could have rolled in some American tanks or whatever. But overall, this is like a story about the people coming together. And I mean the people, not the Japanese government, per se.
Well, so it's like this scrappy underdog uprising to, like, let's all get together and get our old ships and our old fighter jets, and we'll do it together if the government's not going to help us.
right. Which is not to say there isn't a military technology involved, but yeah, obviously it's post-war. Japan was disarmed, so lots of things going on there. Another thing that they touched upon a great deal, which is surprising for kind of like any kind of modern Japanese movie, is like there's a lot of really a clear-eyed view at PTSD. Obviously, the main character, he's a survivor of World War II, kamikaze pilot. In fact, you learn this in the first 5 minutes of the movie. Basically, a kamikaze pilot who's still alive. That shouldn't be. And a lot of the people that he meets coming back home treat him that way. He kind of hides this information because he's ashamed of it, that he didn't go down in glory for the sake of the government. And his whole story is a sort of a redemption story, as you might imagine. His story is that he doesn't believe he should be alive, which is like sad, right? Why would anyone feel that, especially for like a lost cause like that war was? Other things that are interesting in this is that a lot of the production quality is like really top notch. Like that period in Japanese history is super interesting to me. Transition between old Japan and new Japan, especially the post-war where new fashion styles, new technology, obviously Western influence is very, very strong. So you see the rebuilding of Tokyo from like literal rubble to high-end, you know, Western style concrete buildings. And yes, you do have Godzilla stomping through those and thrashing some buildings. No Tokyo Tower yet, obviously. So, but there is a lot of urban destruction, which we all want to see in a Godzilla movie. But another cool part is that a lot of the action happens on the water. And mainly because there is not a lot of city to be destroyed at that time, because it'd been destroyed by the fire bombings. And I think that's actually really cool that a lot of the action happened on the water, because like it makes it feel like a little bit like Jaws, you know. Maybe they got some influence from that. Like a lot of the characters are on this like dinky wooden boat up against this horrendous, ferocious monster. So that adds to a lot of the tension as well. And I think this movie has like a lot of great action and a lot of great drama. you know, the acting true to form for Godzilla movies is over the top and melodramatic. But I think it's appropriate for the kind of story that they're trying to tell. It's not like a sweeping epic. It's just a really personal story, but with a lot of deep, I don't know, like emotional touch points, I guess, due to like a lot of the resentment from the war. So really, really interesting. The CG is actually, I think, really quite good. Apparently, this movie had like a ridiculously small budget or something to that effect. And there's like video documentaries on YouTube or whatever of the kind of the lengths that the CG team went to recreate some of the impressive action sequences. It's not really on the Hollywood like Avengers level, but it looks pretty darn good. I think this movie really, you know, punches above its weight class for the budget of the movie, and it really sets you in that time and place and is worthy of being included in like the pantheon of great Godzilla movies.
It's much more grounded and more genuine than these sort of grand mythological, you know, stories that both the American version has in it. Even the Japanese films have gotten very invested in the matchups, right? And the huge rosters of other monsters and things. This is much more of a simple, zoomed-in story based on the humans. Yeah,
this series has been going on so long since the 1960s. I think 1965 was the original. Yeah, I think that's true because it was the 70th anniversary this year? It was a large anniversary. It was happening while I was in Tokyo, actually. There were some things to coordinate with that. And like the first movie is actually a really kind of emotional piece, a lot of cynicism to do with the war, because literally 1965, that's not long after the war when it started. Obviously, Godzilla is a nuclear war allegory about basically technology and hubris. And the impotence of humans against such forces of nature. So this is kind of a return to form. Yeah, we've had these kind of like schlocky kind of matchups that are these big kind of fisticuffs, and I think those have a place too. And I think those are also great. Like I love them. There's a kind of a different Godzilla for every generation, and I think that this is a really suitable entry for this generation.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, it's been a couple of years since I've seen it. My memories are a little hazy, but I do recall enjoying it. And Shin Godzilla as well, for different reasons.
Right, yeah. Different takes.
Excellent. Well, speaking of sort of storied franchises, one of the few things I was able to get to this week is I've been continuing to work through the Mission Impossible series. I watched a bunch of them when I was flying to and from Australia earlier in the year. I hadn't had access to the rest of them, but finally watched Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. So that was the fifth film in the series of eight now, I think. So, and this was the first also by Christopher McQuarrie, who I think directs like basically the rest of them, the last four films. Whereas the first four were all completely different directors, different casts largely, like, other than Tom Cruise, obviously, but the sort of the backup crew was always different in each of those films. And so, I mean, up front, I think this is probably the best made of the four. It's most consistent, of the five that I've seen. It's probably the most well-made and consistent. It's probably not the most interesting. It's a little bit more predictable and by the numbers, I think, at this point. And it seems like from here on out, it's the same director, it's the same cast, it's a little bit more set in its way. I mean, it is still an incredibly fun film, just the set pieces, the stunt scenes, especially knowing, I mean, it's easy to be to joke on Tom Cruise, obviously, but he's literally doing those stunts in most cases. It is pretty impressive seeing him literally holding onto the side of a plane as it's taking off, which is ridiculous. I don't think it quite hits the highs of some of the other films for me. Like, I think four, was it Ghost Protocol? Probably had the most interesting tech. And three probably had the best story, I think, especially with Philip Seymour Hoffman. There were some really cool moments there. So this isn't particularly memorable in any of those senses, but it's just, they've really settled on the formula by this point with Rogue Nation. And it seems they continue on with that formula from here on out. Have you seen many of these films, Mark?
I think I've seen the first two movies. You know, I have nothing to complain about. I actually like kind of like bombastic Hollywood spy action movies, but I don't know, a lot of them are just really formulaic, so I have a hard time remembering which ones
I've seen
and haven't seen.
They do blow together. I mean, you do definitely have to turn your brain off. It's a little ridiculous how little geopolitical implications there are with this American institution just globe-trotting around the world and blowing things up and killing people in interesting places. So definitely don't think about it too hard. It's very much about American exceptionalism. It's literally the line in this that Ethan Hunt is the manifestation of destiny, which seems like it's almost self-aware of what they're doing there. It's good. I mean, we talked a little bit about this in context of Indiana Jones, of just like the globe-trotting nature of just a lot of interesting places that you don't often see in these big budget films. So it's just fun to see that. So yeah, if you want to turn your brain off, it's good fun.
We definitely need some of that every now and again.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. Well, I could talk on for a while, but I think we've talked at length. Yeah, I like the rhythm of how this new format is going. I think I'm still in the same old mode of covering one game for longer, but that's because I think that's kind of how I've been playing them. I just kind of like to take a bigger bite of something for a little longer, you know?
Yeah, I've been sampling a little more, shall we say. That's been a little apparent. But a lot of shorter games as well, sampling's so good. Yeah.
Yeah, sampling is good. I'm going to sample some other titles next episode as well. So, yeah, that's good. Let's mix it up. And, you know, if the listeners have any requests, happy to hear those as well.
Yeah, if we've got lots of thoughts on a particular game, we will still double down hard on that. And especially if we've both played it. I've got a couple more retro games banked up to talk about very soon. Hoping to get back to the tabletop now that I'm feeling better. I've got a few more solo things have arrived until I can get some more people over here again, I guess.
Yeah, I'm going to want to talk about Metroid Prime in more depth. Mm. Obviously, we're going to have our Pokemon TCG talk. Alex McKenzie has convinced me that I need to finally finish off Tales of Symphonia, which I'm pretty darn close on. I feel like RPGs, it's hard to tell. There's so many of these false endings. I think I'm pretty close, though. So
have you killed God yet? So.
Well, how many gods have I killed? And I did finish Metaphoria Fantasio, so I'd like to give a little revisit that one also. Yeah, lots we'll be talking about. Plenty of retro games and RPGs and tabletop games.
Lots to look forward to. Excellent. Well, if you have any questions or comments on our games or films that we've discussed today, you can contact us at omnigamersclub@gmail.com or at our website, omnigamers.club.
That's right. Follow us on YouTube if you haven't seen our videos there. We post videos of our episodes as they come out. If you want to listen to our older episodes, you can catch those only in audio form. Going way back, and you know, we always cover new and old games that are not necessarily in the zeitgeist, so maybe you can listen to older takes on games as well to see what we're covering then. It's interesting to check those out. And if you want to follow along with us in real time, of course we're on Blue Sky on our personal accounts. I'm Mark Yuasa there, MarkYuasa. And yourself, Daniel?
You can find me at Board Game Feast at Blue Sky and the Omnigamers Club account there as well.
There you go. Yeah, we'd love to hear what you have to say. Please send us your feedback. It gives us inspiration to keep producing these episodes week after week.
Yes, always appreciate hearing from listeners and getting some perspective and suggestions. So, thanks for listening. Thank you, Mark. And remember to have a balanced diet of games.
Bye. Bye.